Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Bob Lefsetz podcast. My guest this week is Giles Martin, producer, mixer extraordinaire. Giles, good to have you.
Oh, Bob, it's so nice to see you.
Thank you. You know, the elephant in the room, of course, is your father is George Martin, who produced the Beatles records.
Yeah.
What year were you born?
I was born in 69. I was actually born on John Lennon's birthday, October 9th, 1969.
And,
I think my dad was doing Abbey Road when I was born. And John came to the studios, and my dad told him that I was born on the same day as him, as his birthday. And John said, now you know what sort of arsehole he's going to turn out to be like, then. So that's how I came into the world.
You know, that was one of the great things in the Jan Wenner book. He was talking about meeting John Lennon and going to dinner with or lunch with him in San Francisco with Yoko. And fans came up for autographs, and John said, fuck off.
Yeah, that was his thing. I mean, he was – my dad always said about John that he was one of those people that – you wanted to be close to, but you were scared of being close to because you could be so acerbic. You know, like the cool kid at school, that's what John Lennon was like.
Wow. So since you shared a birthday, did that ever come up as, you know, obviously John Lennon died 11 years after you were born. But did you ever celebrate, you know, and acknowledge it, that it was identical?
No. It haunts me. It's one of those things that, I mean, there's been occasions – you know, I did the Love Show in Vegas, and then they did a documentary on it. And the screen of the documentary was on my birthday because it was celebrating John Lennon's birthday. It's always that thing. It's like there's something, can you go to this? It's John Lennon's birthday. And you go, well, that's actually, it clashes with my birthday as well. So there's that. It's a curse more than one.
Well, it's like someone who has a birthday on Christmas.
Yeah, exactly.
They only get one
it's
gift.
Not as bad as that, but it is like that.
Okay, so you're born in 69. How long does it take until you recognize what your father does for a living?
Oh, a long time. A long time, funnily enough. It's you have to understand, I tell this to people and they don't believe me, but my dad wasn't at all cool because he did the Beatles when I was growing up.
Not cool to you or cool to people in general?
Cool to people in general. I remember there was a time where he couldn't get work because he'd done the Beatles. You know, because he went off, you know, my period of growing up was I grew up here in Los Angeles for 2 years. At the age of six, my father was working with the band America. And he came back. We came back from Los Angeles, went back in London again. And, you know, he found it hard to get work.
Well, you know, it's kind of funny. A friend of mine is Bob Ezrin, another legendary producer. Yeah. And he did Pink Floyd, The Wall, one of the biggest albums of all time. And he came back to Toronto waiting, and the phone didn't ring.
Yeah, that's... It's funny what happens like that. And so, you know, and also, I played the guitar. I was really into like Humble Pie. I was massively into Steve Ray Vaughan. You know, I thought.
Really?
Yeah, I was blues guitarist. I was going to be, you know, having definitely not been born in the ghetto, I thought I'd be a blues guitarist. And that was my passion. I was then really into Free, into Paul Kossoff and Paul Rodgers.
You know, there's a double album on A&M. It's called Molten Gold or something. Not only does it have, you know, I'll Be Creepin' and The Stealer. Those, you go back and listen, that shit was unbelievable.
They were great. I mean, there's footage of them at the Isle of Wight Festival. I don't know if you've seen it with, you know, it's funny when you see the two microphones. I'm trying to work out why Paul Rodgers has two microphones. Is it because one's monitors and one's the PA? I mean, who knows?
Right.
But you know, there's footage of that, and it's beautiful, simple, economic in music. There's drums, bass, and guitar, and
right.
That's it. It's like, you know, Led Zeppelin. It's that format, and you kind of miss that these days to a certain extent. But I was into that, and it wasn't really. I don't think I'd heard the White Album until I was about 19.
Really?
Yeah. I don't think. But I remember being on a plane with my dad, and it was when I wanted to do music as a kid.
To what degree? Because your father worked in music, to what degree was music playing in your household?
You know, we didn't have a hi-fi at home.
You did not have a hi-fi?
We didn't have
How about
speakers.
Even in your room?
No. My sister and I have a sister who's 2 years older, and we had one of those. We had a plastic kids turntable.
Right.
And I remember the first album I remember having. We had a bunch of records, obviously records that my dad had at that time. One was Abbey Road, which I suppose it would have only been at this stage, about 6 years old, I thought, which is kind of crazy thinking about kind of getting old, 6 years old. And then the other one was Live and Let Die, the motion picture soundtrack my father recorded. I remember having the, you remember the cover, this is the great thing about albums, you remember the covers of albums.
Of course.
We had a Carole King album as well. It wasn't Tapestry, it was a kid's album she made. And we played, and I remember that, but my father, my father played the piano a lot. He was doing a lot of arranging at that time. In fact, when I was at play school, sort of at the age of 4 or 5, they went around the class asking what the parents did. And I said, my dad just sits home and plays the piano. You know, that was because, so there was music in the house, but my parents are very careful, and I don't know why. I've never really understood why they sort of kept music away from me to a certain degree. I went on my own journey, and then me and my dad met up later for various reasons. But
so just to go to the end before we go back to the beginning, at what point did you meet up later?
Well, my father, which is known now, but we kept it secret, lost his hearing.
Now, was that attributable to his work, or was it just genetic?
He always blames it on his work. He used to sit, if you look at the photographs or videos of the Beatles, he would sit between the speakers. You know, you see this famous such as Studio 2 where the band are performing this. There's a couple of films you see where my father's stuck with his head between the speakers. And he also blamed it on Jeff Beck. He worked on Wired and Blow by Blow in 1970.
Which are the two best Jeff Beck records.
Yeah, which are the two best Jeff Beck. And even Jeff says there's two Jeff Beck records. But he blames Jeff for going deaf. I mean, it's that, you know, I know a lot about it because my father, it was you know, his one regret in life is his deafness. And so he started going deaf, and he didn't want to tell anyone.
And how old was he at that point?
Let me have a think. I would have been 16. So he's probably in his early 50s.
Okay.
And he noticed it when we do different kilohertz cycles lining up a tape machine.
Right.
And he went in the studio, and you could see the meters move, and you couldn't hear it. And it was like 15 cycles and 10 cycles or whatever it is. And he realized that he couldn't, you know, he suddenly realized that there was sound playing and he wasn't hearing it. And he was a person that was known for his ears. And he realized it would be the end of him. And so he brought me in like almost like a seeing eye dog. And that was my job. My job was to hear the high frequencies. And he taught me, it's a bizarre way of learning. He taught me hearing from a high end down, because I have to replace what he couldn't hear. I wouldn't talk to him about what he could hear, but like high violins and cymbals, and they would move further down. And we'd do tests together on a piano where the notes would start disappearing. And so I learned about frequencies from that, funny enough, because I was aware I could hear what he wasn't hearing, if that makes sense.
And outside the studio in the home, would he wear the hearing aids?
Yeah, he would wear hearing aids. It was a big push for him. He always said that, you know, if you wear hearing aids, you're deaf, but if you wear glasses, you're not seen as being blind. And that bothered him, the stigma of it, actually. But yeah, he wore hearing aids, and his hearing became, you know, he died actually 2 years ago on March 28th, so 2 years ago last week, I guess. He was pretty profoundly deaf when he died. He could hear me pretty well because I've got a low voice. And its frequencies. But there's very funny stories. He worked with a band, Ultravox, in the 80s. I remember I was 16. And he came out of the studio, and the bass player, Chris Cross, was going in and said, how's it going in there, George? Is it going okay? And my dad held up his plate and said, 2 boiled eggs. He thought he asked him what he had for lunch. So, you know, it's lots, you know. And as a kid, my mum, who's still alive, has a wicked sense of humor. You know, there'd be things like, you know, she'd say, there's a nice green taxi, and he'd go, where's an ice cream factory? You know, there was a constant in the home. There was a constant things. And it was just a thing we grew up with.
So you're growing up. Your sister's 2 years older. What is she? What's her life like now?
Well, she's amazing. Her husband died 6 years ago. She has 3 children, which I try and look after as well. And she is she runs 2 companies actually now. She's a marketeer and does things like that. Nothing to do with music.
And that is in London?
That's in London, yeah.
Okay, so now you're in the house. Your father's playing the piano. When he was working, could you interrupt him?
Yeah, I mean, I remember being on a skiing holiday. This is how my dad, who I loved dearly and was a very nice man, was pretty hard on me. I mean, you know, I was okay at music. I was better than music than my friends. You know, it wasn't, I'm no genius, but I was, and I remember being 14 years old. You remember these things. And he was doing an arrangement. I think he was trying to work. He nearly wrote the music for The Mission, the film The Mission.
Right.
He sadly got fired by when they, you know, classic film style. And he was trying to compose something, and we were on holiday, and he was using the hotel piano. And I went up to him, and he said, hello, you know, hi, Giles. I said, you know, he goes, how are you doing? I said, yeah. He goes, you know, what do you want to do? I said, you know, I'd love to do what you do, Dad. You know, I'm learning, you know, learning the piano and stuff. And he goes, you won't be able to do that. And I said, well, why not? And he goes, I don't think you're good enough.
I know.
Can you imagine?
Does that still hobble you today?
God, it hobbles me. It hobbles me. I mean, I said to him on his deathbed. My dad took a long time to die. It's a terrible thing to say, but he'd find this funny as well. We'd joke about it. We were very close. I'd say I'd come in, and you know, I ended up sleeping next to him at certain stages. And I'd say in the morning, I'd say, "You're still here, then, are you?" And he'd go, "Oh, piss off, Giles."
How long did it take him to die?
Well, he was sick. He was sick, and he became very sick in January. He died in March, but it was a long process. And it was. There's nothing good about it apart from the fact you get to say all the things you want to say. And I said to him, "Dad, do you ever think you're not good at music?" And he was immobile, and he closed his eyes. I was holding his hand. He said, "That's a strange thing to ask me." And I said, "Well, not really, because I'd just been asked to do this film, and I always think, you know, I can't do it. You know, even, you know, I told you I was seeing Steven Tyler on Saturday. I feel nervous about, you know, I'm constantly nervous about meeting people." He goes, "But I think you're great at what you do. I think you're amazing. I think you're better than I am." I said, "Well, thanks, Dad, but I'm not. But thank you." I said, "Do you ever feel like that?" And he closed his eyes, and he thought, and he opened them, and he said, "No, I always thought I was brilliant." and it's you know, and he was, and it's the thing that it was just envy. I felt envy, and I think it stemmed from that moment when he said to me, you know, "I don't think you're good enough." That it's a constant battle.
But by the same token, when he did say on his deathbed how great you were, did that compensate for it?
No, it doesn't, because you wear the clothes that you think motivate you, you know, without sounding like a therapy session. But you do kind of, it suits you to go through this, you know. It's I'm quite a happy person, and I feel like I'm reasonably nice to people. But you know, you go through this air of desperation that people don't realize that you do in your studios, and then you come out the other side, and you have to question everything you do, and it's good to have that in a way, and so it suits me.
So every time you do a project, it's like pushing a boulder up a hill. You're not quite sure you can do it.
It's a mixture of pushing a boulder up the hill, and then the boulder will sail down uninterrupted until it hits the next mountain. Yeah, I mean that's it. It's like a you know, I'm terrible. Wait a second, I'm a genius. No, I'm terrible again. That's what it's like.
When people approach you for work, do you ever say, "No, I don't think I can do this"?
That's a good. No, I don't really. I think, you know, if I've done the other thing I couldn't do, I could probably not do this in a strange way. it's a nice way of constantly surprising myself. And I'm not saying this through any false modesty. It's generally how I feel.
So let's go back. You're in the house. Your father's playing the piano. There's no stereo in the living room. You have the kid's record player. What kind of music are you listening to?
Well, I mean, I say we're listening to. I generally, the records I had when I was very young, the records I had was with the records my father was making. You know, he was working on Paul McCartney albums, on America. I was aware of America. He worked with Neil Sedaka. You know, there was a. I knew all of this stuff because it was on in the house, or he'd be on the car. He would actually listen to mixes in the car. Okay. You know, I'd be where's Dad, and he'd be sitting outside the car because we had no stereo at home, and then. And then it's funny. I remember the first album I ever bought was a cassette because I'm a cassette era. Yeah, was ELO Time.
Wow.
Yeah, which isn't. And I said to Jeff, I met Jeff Lynne. You know, I know Jeff Lynne now. And I said, "Yours is the first album I ever bought." He goes, "You know, what was that?" I said, "ELO Time." He goes, "Well, that was a shit album."
because I'm a huge fan of El Dorado, but time.
Yeah,
no,
I know.
No,
it's
I'm
not a good album. But you can't change history. That was
exactly.
The fact. I mean, it's like, you know, you do interviews, you go, should you make up something really cool? Like, you know, it's rumors.
I'm glad that you're honest.
You know?
It's like, you know, I read these interviews. What are your favorite books? What are your favorite records?
Oh, yeah.
And they're trying to look cool as to both what the truth is.
There's no point. And then it was, you know, there was a, you know, obviously there was, it's strange. I mean, there was, you know, there were bands around I liked as a kid. Listen Like Thieves by INXS, which was, I remember, because an Australian friend of mine. I loved Lloyd Cole and the Commotions, who were, you know, there was
never made it over here, but
never made it. But, you know, there was a bunch of bands in that era. I didn't really, it's funny, the 80s didn't really strike me. You know, I was growing up in the 80s. I mean, but I didn't really, that whole.
Well, that's interesting because most of the sound, certainly for the first half of the 80s, came from England.
Yeah, but it didn't touch me in the right way. It wasn't like, you know, it wasn't a.
You were a blues guy.
Yeah, I'm a blues. As you can tell by my voice, I'm a blues guy through and through. But yeah, I was a blues guy. I liked music pushing air through your ears. You know, I liked the sense. Didn't like the sense of. Electronica hadn't hit me. I appreciate it more now than I did then. And then I went to, you know, through Scub, you know, you learn to play the guitar and the piano, and you get into guitar players, basically. You start listening to guitar players, you know.
So how did you become a guitar player?
Well, my parents, I was banned from playing the guitar by my parents.
Literally?
Yeah, they didn't want me to play the guitar. They thought I'd be a failed rock star. I think there was an element, in a funny way, with my father, and this sounds terrible, but that he there was one side he was worried about me being a failure, and there was another side he was worried about me making him look bad by being this wannabe rock star. I think there was an element of that, definitely. But I actually bought a ukulele because I could afford a ukulele, and learned to play the ukulele. And the ukulele has my sister's son, I had to play ukulele, explained to him, it's, you know, it's the four strings are the same as the guitar. You just have to fill in the bass strings later when you learn to play the guitar. So I did that. Became not about a ukulele player, and then borrowed at school. I was at a boarding school, and a guy had a guitar, so I used to use his guitar. And then, for some reason, I don't know where this performance thing came from. Actually, still my best friend, we decided we'd go busking, and we ended up playing in pubs. And we were about 15 or 16. We played in pubs when we only knew three songs.
And what were those three songs?
American Pie.
Okay.
I should be making up something cooler.
No, no, that's good for a bar. You get people singing along.
Is She Really Going Out With It by Joe Jackson?
Love that record.
But not the middle section because we couldn't work it out. And I think No Woman, No Cry, I think, were the three songs we knew.
Wow, very good that you can even remember that.
Yeah, well, you know, I can still play them there.
And so, okay, so you're playing in the pubs, and what's the step after that?
Playing the pubs, then we started playing in bars. I went to university, and then
I was at
Manchester.
Okay,
so I got a place at Berklee College of Music, and it's funny. My dad said, you know, and I don't regret this. My dad said, I don't want you to go to Berklee College of Music. You know, if you really want to do this music thing, I can teach you, but go and get a proper degree. And I was, you know, I was good at English, and I was reasonably academic, and I did a degree in American politics and literature. Would you believe?
No.
So yeah, I know, and played music, and I was at Manchester. Manchester had a whole, you know, the Stone Roses, Happy Mondays.
Well, that was the Tony Wilson era.
Yeah, it was the Tony Wilson era, 1989, and it was great. It was fantastic. It was a fantastic time. And
why didn't almost none of those bands make it in the United States?
There was nothing slick about them. There was nothing slick about any of those bands, and I think that in that era there was a slickness to your music over here, and I think that's what it was. I think there's that undercurrent goth era of, you know, Never Tear Us Apart and Joy Division,
right,
and that sort of stuff. I think that kind of bubbled under for a bit in America, but it wasn't really. It was such a scene. And then, funny enough, things like the Chemical Brothers, which came. I was at university with the Chemical Brothers, and actually, the guitarist from Radiohead was at Manchester with me. There was this scene that broke into America after that. So just after we were doing stuff. Yeah.
Now, when you were in college, university, as you say, the Hacienda, all that stuff, were those big things? Did you go?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I was choose your weapon of choice. I was never really. You know, the whole ecstasy and what we used to call fast drug boom.
What is that?
You know, like, you know, the amphetamine, ecstasy, dance world. Okay. I never really got into. I mean, it was crazy. I remember at my at the final, we used to call them balls, whatever they're called in America. You know, the end of term thing was at a club called the Roxy, which had a rubber dance floor that used to throb in time with the music. That was intentional. Okay. And I stood on the balcony and everyone was like, it was the acid days of the smiley face and everyone singing free your mind, will must be free, all that sort of stuff. But it was like a German rally. Everyone was doing exactly the same thing. And I thought, this isn't freeing your mind. This is, and I was more of a stoner culture guitar player. You know, it wasn't really my scene. But so the Hacienda was very much a dance-driven culture. I regret that I didn't become more part of it because I think it's very influential. But I mean, when I did my final exams at university, the guy next to me was sucking a dummy.
Wow.
You know, it was a pretty crazy time. And there's,
but to what degree, living in Manchester at that time, did that culture dominate or other people were aware of it?
It was pretty big. It reverberated around the UK and Europe. That dance culture and those bands. It was the biggest music hub in it, just by coincidence. It was the biggest party town. You know, Manchester had 36,000 students when I was there. It was pretty big. You know, there's much bigger places now, but it was, and so it did. Yeah, it was pretty influential. And then out of that, obviously, stemmed bands like Oasis.
Right.
Which was, you know, when I left college, you know, Oasis started to become very big. And funny, if they, people get quite upset when I say this, they did the Beatles a lot of favors.
And what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, the Beatles, in the UK anyway, I can't talk about America because I wasn't living there. But in the UK, you know, and probably, I think in a funny way, rightfully so, were a band that had happened. And Oasis put them... They'll always be on a pedestal. I'm not saying that right. Without Oasis, but they certainly became a cultural relevant band much quicker, or had that resurgence in the UK and stayed there from the Oasis period onward, because we're not as big as the Beatles, and then almost like when Oasis said we're bigger than the Beatles, it was the same as John Lennon saying we're bigger than Jesus.
Right.
It was a strange kind of, you know, reflection on what went on before. And it was, you know, it was an amazing time. And I was playing in a band, a deeply unsuccessful band, a sort of indie rock band that was great because I was with friends and we toured Germany and went to Canada and did this sort of stuff. And it was, you know, it was a time where if you can be in a van with a band and go on tours and sleep in buses and sleep, and, you know, I slept in a dog basket in Coventry and, you know, and all this sort of stuff, you can do that. You can get on with people in the studios and you can get on with people in life. And it's a, you know, if you, you know, that it taught me a huge amount.
Let's go back. You're talking about the club with the rubber floor and your viewpoint on that. Your identity, are you a member of the group or are you an outsider judging the group?
I've always felt like an outsider, not judging in a bad way, but I've always been an outsider. You know, I've always been, I was a good rugby player. I was in this team, you know, and played to quite a high standard, but always felt like an outsider. I was the only guitar player, musician, in a rugby team, you know, obviously. But I always felt like I was this. There was this juxtaposition that it suited me. You know, it's funny. You know, you're left. You know, you have to understand that if you're a kid growing up where you're, you know, I grew up in studios. I grew up in Montserrat in the Caribbean, where there were these bands. I mean, you know, I'd have to have dinner with Earth, Wind and Fire. Or with Stevie Wonder, but it wasn't. It sounds amazing, but as a kid, you're just told to sit at the table and behave. You know, that's how it is, and you're on show all the time. And so you become this observer. You become by nature this sort of outsider to a certain degree. And I was the same when I was at university. It doesn't leave you.
Does it make you more comfortable with famous, rich celebrities?
Well, it's one of those. Yes, it does. I never take. I don't see them as anything different. I think that's what it is. I mean, right. I see they can fire you fairly easily, but I mean, so can anyone else. Do you know what I mean? It's not like, you know, it doesn't. I think I have a good relationship with famous rich celebrities, if you like, because I'm always honest. That's the thing.
Right. Well, I went to college where 45% of the people were from prep school, and a lot of them, their parents literally ran household name companies. And where I grew up, I didn't know anybody like that. And it really taught me how to interact, that they're just normal people. But a lot of people don't have that experience, and they're starstruck even to this day.
Yeah. I mean, it's it's, you know, you meet people who are impressive and unimpressive, like, as you know, a lot of people, right. you're a huge influence and, you know, a lot of people that are celebrities follow you, you know,
right.
like people I know get into me goes, you know, Bob said this, it's a responsibility, I suppose.
Right.
But I think that the funny thing about it, like if you take Paul McCartney, for instance, who I know very well, and actually love him dearly. He's always been good to me. He's a bit like Forrest Gump in a way. There's something very interesting about him, apart from the fact he's Paul McCartney, but his experiences, he said, are just extraordinary. You know, it's like, you know, you're talking to him, he'll go from the time, you know, when recounting when he met Elvis to being in the same hotel as the England World Cup football team when they won the World Cup to, you know, Muhammad Ali to whatever. It's a bit like Forrest Gump. It's that sort of, you know, I know it's trivializing something that's important, but to me, it's kind of like you have to break it down to what you understand.
Right. Same thing like Quincy Jones, although Quincy advertises a little bit more, but you sit there, when I was with this king and I was that, blah, blah, blah.
Well, yeah, it's funny. Quincy, I know Quincy because I've known him growing up because he was the contemporary of my dad. They were very close, in fact, even though they're sort of like counter-opposite. They're like yin and yang, right. if you like, the production, where they both have the same kind of backgrounds, but white and black. You know, I think I can say that. It's like, you know,
I don't think there's anything offensive in that.
Quincy is a pure jazz artist, and my dad was a Baroque white, you know, not actually low class. Not, you know, my dad transformed himself to an upper-class gent from a very humble background. And they both worked their way through, had to navigate their way through society and the rules of society to get where they got to. And they did very well. And they were very, very close. They were incredibly close. And I still talk to Quincy.
Okay, we'll return to this conversation with Giles Martin, sound experience leader for Sonos and son of George Martin and producer and mixer extraordinaire in his own right, in a moment. This is Bob Lefsetz. Do you like the podcast? If so, come check out the one-on-one interviews I'll be having with movers and shakers in the music and media industries at the end of April at my Music Media Summit in Santa Barbara. Not only can you listen into the conversations, but you can meet the bigwigs and hang. They have insight and influence over where it's all going. Go to musicmediasummit.com for tickets and more information. See you in Santa Barbara. Let's continue the conversation with the sound experience leader for Sonos and son of the great Beatles engineer, George Martin. Let's go back to Montserrat, because that's one thing we noticed from reading the credits, which we do inveterately in the 70s, and when we say Air Studios in Montserrat. How did that come together to the degree you know?
Well, I know. I mean, my father, it was funny. My dad, we talked about once before, and I said, you know, we shouldn't really talk about this. But my dad actually did. He managed to sell his royalties for the Beatles stream, and ended up with a trade off, which is part of this record company Chrysalis, and he ended up building studios with the money he got, and he decided, wouldn't it be great? He wanted to build a studio that was unlike no other. And he looked at building a studios on a ship. That was his first idea. And he actually was thinking about buying a Scandinavian ferry and building a studios there. And then he realized the engine noise would be getting to be isolation on a ferry's nightmare. So he ended up looking for a place, and he chose Montserrat, which is an island in the Caribbean, very rugged, no white sand beaches, black sand beaches, and on a volcano. And it was a crazy idea. And he built a world-class studio. So he built a studio which was like Abbey Road, but in the Caribbean. And it became probably one of the most successful studios, as far as professionally goes, in at that time. You know, everything from Brothers in Arms to Michael Jackson to, you know, the number of, you know, to the Police. Obviously, the Police recorded everything out there. Elton John recorded out there. Just about everyone went to Montserrat. It never made any money. I mean, because it was a really bad idea, because to have a studios that's just one studios with everything else, you know, with the cost, I think, you know, it cost him on top of, you know, it cost him $500,000 after he built it. But it was great. You know, he was one of those guys that didn't really, he was a proper artist, and the fact he didn't do anything for the reason why he did it is because he thought it was a good idea and it was fun.
Okay. you know, the English are world travelers. I've never been to Montserrat. Where, literally, where is it in the Caribbean?
It's next to Antigua. It's okay. Next to Antigua. You can see it because sadly, with Montserrat, the volcano erupted. This volcano, this place we played to as kids. In fact, I went up to, I climbed the mountains with Elton John's boyfriend at the time. You know, on the and I came back to school and he'd married, and then he got engaged to Renata, who was the tape-op. And it was like, wait a second. You know, this bizarre life you lead, or I left. And we used to climb this waterfall. And all of that doesn't exist anymore. It's now mountains because the volcano, which was just this hot springs, decided to erupt after 120 years and destroyed the island. So it's next to Antigua.
Okay, and when you were there, how many people would live there?
There were 12,000. Now there's about 3,500 on it.
And then how big was the island?
It's getting bigger. That's the answer. The islands are, it's difficult because I bet say the size of the Isle of Wight, that would be nothing to anyone in America. It's 3 miles by 4 miles. So, sorry, no, 7 miles by 4 miles.
So very small.
Small island, yeah. Small island. There was nothing really on it. And that's what was, you know, and you could only get to it by chartered small plane. The runway was tiny. And that's why I think my father chose it because, you know, in fact, Sting had a house out there. Elton had a house out there. Jeff Emmerich, who was an engineer that my father, he ended up building a house over there. You know, you could go there and people would not get hassled because there was no real white tourists on the island.
And you lived there full time?
No, I spent because of trying to run the studios, I was at boarding school, and there was a period of time where myself and my sister would go there, and we would pretty much live there because when we went at school, we'd be on Montserrat. You know, I remember having hard feet because we wouldn't wear shoes. You know, we'd run down tarmac roads and stuff like that, and my friends were Montserratians.
Now, the studio was destroyed in a storm?
The studio got hit by a thing called Hurricane Hugo. And it was a bit like the recent hurricane that just hit the West Indies. And, it was pretty much, you know, there was the Bösendorfer grand piano actually at the end of it had some mold growing out of it and the desk was ruined and, you know, and it was at a stage, to be honest with you, where the studios never made any money and was a great thing to have, but the hurricane was the final straw.
And he still owned it when the hurricane hit?
He still owned it. That was quite an interesting story. So it had insurance against hurricane, and it was insured with a company called Lloyd's of London, very famous insurance company. And they sent a man out called Mr. Hook, I always remember this, who arrived in Antigua and then disappeared. And he had $500,000, and he disappeared. And they found him in solution. He built a hotel. Isn't that
brilliant? Wow,
yes. It was one of those things where the Lloyd's of London said, well, he's no longer our guy because he's with Carib Insurance. So the West, as soon as he lands in Antigua, it's one of those things. And, you know, the rules of the West Indies can be slightly different to the other rules.
Did he collect on the insurance ultimately?
No, I don't think completely. But I think, listen, it's funny, you know, he was, he didn't want for much. It didn't make a difference. You know, it made a difference, but in the end of it, The whole Montserrat thing was looking back on life as he did at the age of 90. He looked back and goes, you know, would he take it away from him? Would he take that trip with the amount of records that were made, the amount of fun that people had, from bands that recorded there, from James Taylor to Jerry Rafferty to just about, I mean, it was extraordinary, the range. I mean, from, you know, Status Quo to Stevie Wonder. It was kind of bizarre. It was like, you know, everyone went there. I think the Climax Blues Band were the first person to record over there. And so it was he made something that made things. And that was the thing. Like, you know, the true pleasure in life has to be coming up with an idea and seeing it happen.
So there was another air studio in London?
There was another air studio in London, which he sold to build Montserrat. And then he came back and persuaded Chrysalis, which is the company that he'd sort of sold out to build another studio's facilities in London called Air Studios Lyndhurst, which is a very good studios now. It was funny, he kind of got his own back because having lost all his royalties, he built a studios that was meant to cost, I think 8 million, 7 million pounds and cost 23 million pounds. Like that. You know, it's like he built this, you know. And it's a beautiful, you know, it's like Hans Zimmer, it's his favorite studios in the world. So, you know, Coldplay have recorded there. I mean, a lot of people have been to Air, so it's a great place.
Okay, so you are in university, you're playing different gigs, you graduate, and then what?
Well, while I was playing, I had a French girlfriend, and while I was playing gigs,
how does one get a French girlfriend?
She was at university.
Oh, okay.
I got her drunk, I think. She was at university, and she knew a place in France. We're looking for a band to play at New Year's Eve. And so this is myself and my friend and a drum machine. We were one of those bands. We had, like, you know, the quality of the capital K. And we go down. We went down, and a guy saw us play, and I played some of my own songs. And he said, you know, would you write some music for my? And I end up writing
music for what?
For commercials. I end up writing music for Elf Aquitaine.
Tell for the American audience what that is.
They sell petrol, gas.
Right.
It's like, it wasn't PC, but I ended up doing 7 commercials while I was at university, and I sort of got a gig doing commercials. And it was great. It was good money, you know, and I couldn't believe it. And then when I left university, I thought, what am I going to do? And I wanted to do music. Ended up working a little bit in music PR. I did PR for UB40 and Tears for Fears.
How did you get those gigs?
I was an intern. At that stage, I wanted to write music, and I could do commercials now, and I thought I'd learn everything. So I was working, ended up meeting someone, getting a job in a PR company. I think it was the funny thing. The guy gave me the job because he wanted the PR account for Air Studios in London, which he didn't get given, and then wanted to fire me because he said, you know. And then there was a guy called Alan Edwards who actually ended up managing David Bowie. He liked me, and he goes, "Well, listen, I believe in you." And I only did 7 months, and I saw a band there called My Life Story at the Marquee, and I said, "You know, I think you're really good, and I'd like to make a record with you." And we went to a studios in the evening, so I'd work in the day and then go and work nights. And they got Single of the Week and NME.
Okay, well, a little bit slower. What made you think you could produce a record?
I don't know.
Had you been into this? How much time?
When I left school, I spent a year as a runner in the studios. I actually hoovered. I vacuumed carpets. And
whose studio was that?
That was Air. That was Air in London.
Air in London. Yeah. Okay. How much time did you spend in the room with your father?
A lot of time, because whenever he had to go in the studios, I went in from the age of 16.
So when you had the band that you wanted to make a record with, you had experience of a sort.
I had been in studios. I knew studios. I knew, you know, I this was what I wanted to do, and I was determined I was going to do it. And I wasn't very good, but they managed to get, you know, NME was a big magazine in the UK. It was a New Musical Express. And they got Single of the Week there, and someone put it on my dad's desk and said, you know, your boy's been up to it. I didn't tell my father I was even doing it. And he goes, really? And he phoned me up and said, how come you've got Record of the Week and New Musical Express? and it was a turning point in my life, because at the same time, I was offered a big job, head of dance press for Warner's. So I was working in this PR company. And I went to go and see this woman. I said, why have you offered me this job? And she goes, we've been recommended to you by these journalists who have said you should employ him. And I said, but I'm terrible at PR. And I phoned up one of the journalists, and he said, I always remember him. He was a guy called Alan Jackson. He wrote for the Times in London. He said, whenever we spoke to you on the phone, you just didn't seem very happy, so we decided to get you another job. So I had a choice. I had £27,000 a year plus car to work at Warner Brothers, or go off and do music for a living. So I went off and did music for a living.
By the same token, there's no safety net.
No, there was no safety net. And I was very lucky that I spent time then, a lot of time with my dad doing stuff. And then when things, I've always been incredibly lucky that when I suddenly remember thinking to myself, oh God, now I'm broke. And then the phone would ring, and a guy called Rob Dickens, who was he ran Warner Brothers, had just started a label, Sony. He goes, I saw you in a magazine. I did a fashion shoot. There we are. That's a glamour and glitz. And he said, you know, do you want to come work for me? I'll pay you £50,000, and you don't have to work full time. And I was like, yeah, great. So yeah, I always managed to get some sort of situation where people. I've always been lucky that people go, you know, hey, do you want to do this? And that gave me the opportunity to actually learn. And I made terrible records and didn't know what I was doing. And then I remember a friend of mine said to me, who I was working in the studios at Rack Studios in London, working on a band.
RAK.
Working on this band who were great. And I knew I wasn't doing a very good job of them. And he was working on this band called Shed 7, who were a band in the 90s. And And we became friends. He goes, you know, once you learn how to make it sound good, it gets kind of boring, he said to me. And I always take that because it took me a while to learn. And I know that people may not like everything I do, but I know it'll sound good. Does that make sense?
Yes, but because, if it's boring, does one continue to want to do it? Where's the thrill?
No, I think that's the thing. You have to find the thrill, and that's the answer. So you have to do different things. You have to approach things differently and do different things.
Which would be like what?
Well, in my case, what I ended up doing is, so I left. I ended up being asked. I do music direction, so I ended up music directing the Jubilee, the first Queen's Jubilee at Buckingham Palace.
Let's go back a few steps here. You graduate from university. At what point do you give up the dream of being a musician?
I did the band for about 6 years. So I was always doing lots of different things at the time. I did the band 6 years. We got signed by a label. We made a record. I didn't. It was sleeping on floors for too long. And I think by the age of 26 or 27, I thought, you know, I don't want to sleep on floors anymore. I've been doing this. I've been playing in pubs since I was 15 years old. I still love playing, but I realized that maybe I'm not going to be the world's greatest singer-songwriter, or, you know, maybe that's not my destiny.
And your parents were saying what about when you were a peripatetic singer-songwriter?
At that stage, my parents, I rebelled against my parents. When I was at university, I didn't care what they said at that stage. You know,
and were they giving you any money, or could you make it being a musician?
No, they didn't give me any money. I mean, I was very lucky. They gave me, I said they didn't give me any money. They gave me, my mum's parents left me £20,000 and when they passed away. And so I bought a flat with a mortgage. You know, it's amazing you could do that now.
And where?
That was in Notting Hill Gate.
Okay.
So that was a good thing. I bought it there because it was cheap.
Right.
And then the guy made the film and everything became expensive, which was super for me. But anyway. Right. I realized that the band wasn't it was I love the guys, they're still my best friends, but it wasn't working.
And what are they doing now?
One's a drummer in, like, he plays with lots of different bands, but of a different era. And the singer works in a bank. The guitarist is still a guitar player, you know. And so
you were really, you and the bank guy were the only people who escaped.
Yeah, yeah. It was. I'm not sure if I escaped in a way, but yeah. And I was at the same time, I was in studios a lot of the time.
How hard was it to give up the dream?
It was harder not making the record I wanted to make with my friends. You know, I wanted to make Pet Sounds, and they wanted to make a Foo Fighters album.
Ah, so it was easier to give it up.
Yeah, so that made it easier when it didn't, you know, I didn't like really what we were doing. So
what'd they say when you quit?
It was one of those things where I was writing all the songs and doing everything, and there was I remember coming to a rehearsal, and they said, you know, how come you write? We want to write the songs. And I went, okay. And then I'd wait 2 weeks, and we wouldn't have any songs. And then I'd go, you know, it was fine. It was fine. Everyone was broke. Everyone, you know, the keyboard player was eating broken biscuits because that's all he could afford. I didn't even know they existed. You'd be able to go to stores and buy biscuit rejects from. Cookie rejects from factories. You know, we lived that life, and it was time, you know.
And so you also talk about your father losing his hearing. At what point do you start working with him?
When I was 16. So that's the backdrop to everything, is I'm okay. Doing that the whole time. And he's working on various records, doing weird projects. And I've always done more than one job at the same time. It's what I'm used to. And so I was doing that while, and then I'd do promo tours with him, and I'd go and do music direction for concerts with him.
What would that be, musical direction for a concert?
Well, funny enough, it was actually quite often we did a thing in Japan where, I mean, it sounds ridiculous, and it was ridiculous, where a concert arranged with UNICEF had Japanese artists. And the idea is they would jam with everyone. It was Bob Dylan, John Bon Jovi, Joni Mitchell, Ry Cooder, INXS. It was like this big rehearsal room. They go, let's jam. You know, one of those dreadful ideas. And so I'd do things like that. I'd go over there and I'd be in charge of the band. The band would be, I mean, Jim Keltner, Pino Palladino, Wix Wickens, Phil Palmer on guitar, Ray Cooper on percussion, you know, good. And so, right. And so good. And so I'd teach them, you know, work the songs out with them and work out arrangements. And
oh, really?
That was my job. Yeah, yeah. That was my job and organize things and that. So I, you know, I always had confidence that I always had a good, you know, I think my father, I learned from my father, as Paul says, a good bedside manner where you can steer musicians in the right way without being pompous, I think.
And do you know how to read music?
I know how to read music, yeah.
And how did you learn that?
I played the French horn in orchestras when I was at school.
And was that your own instigation or your parents said you have to learn an instrument?
No, no. I learned the trombone first because I saw someone play the trombone and I wanted to go meek on the trombone. I thought that'd be a good thing to do. And then the trombone teacher was kind of weird and wanted to play my trombone. It was like kissing an old man. Yeah, so I moved to the French horn. And the French horn was a bit like the French horn, you know, I was good at treble clef in the key of F because the French horn's in the key of F. But I got injured playing rugby and had to stop the French horn. And I was a good horn player. And then you have to go back to it because with bad concussion, you can't play a wind instrument, especially blowing up a balloon like a French horn. So I went back to it and it was like giving birth to a cow. And I decided guitar and piano would be easier.
Stay right there. We'll be back with more of my conversation with Giles Martin, producer extraordinaire, here on the Bob Lefsetz podcast. You're listening to the Bob Lefsetz podcast, recorded at the TuneIn Studios in Venice, California. Each week, I interview a new guest to get their story. I want to find out what makes them tick, and I hope listening to these successful people makes you smarter. If you like the show, subscribe, rate, and review it. Also, please check out earlier episodes. You can hear them all on TuneIn, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And now, more with Giles Martin, sound experience leader for Sonos. So you said you got the gig being the musical director for the Queen's Jubilee.
Yeah.
What year was that?
That was in 2002.
Okay. But in the interim, you're producing records.
In the interim, I'm producing records and working as an in-house bridger at Sony, unsuccessfully. I worked on a sort of, you know, rip-off bands. Like I worked on a girl band that were trying to be like the Dixie Chicks, writing and producing various artists under this guy Rob Dickens, who was a label boss. And it was fascinating. I mean, I'd never been inside a record label before, and my greatest fears are realized, I think. You know,
which are what?
Well, I remember being at an A&R meeting, and there was him, and there, you know, and he's a very nice man. I love him dearly. He's a very nice guy. And really, you know, he taught me a lot because I remember working on this band, and I'd be downstairs in the basement, and he'd listen to it, and he'd go, it doesn't sound like this, and it'd be No Scrubs by TLC. and I go, but I've been in the basement doing this, and this is a multi-million-dollar production. And he'd look at me like, going, well, do you think anyone cares? And that taught me a lot, there's no excuse. I was saying to someone yesterday, actually, if you're making a record, if you're trying to make something, compare it to what you love or compare it to what you think is really, really good and see whether you can beat it, opposed to saying to someone, yeah, but it's my demo. You know, that taught me a lot that the people don't listen with empathy.
Right.
They don't listen to the fact you've done it. They just listen. I realized that, you know, from being an artist and being a musician, seeing the way decisions are made about roster and record labels, and it wasn't for me. I'm too soft for that in a way.
And how, you know, usually you have a certain number of unsuccessful projects and they fire you. Now, what happened in this particular case?
Well, in this particular case, it was his, it wasn't necessarily my responsibility they were unsuccessful. It wasn't okay. down to me. And it got to the stage where, you know, I'd sort of was garnering a reputation for doing, you know, bigger projects. And the BBC approached me and saw whether I would record the first Queen's Jubilee concert, which they had a bunch of artists, because I'd worked on...
Okay, is this the same 2002 project?
Same 2002 project.
So you're still working at Sony at that
moment?
I still
work at Sony. And I left Sony because I realized that... And there was undertones of... At the same time, my father was talking to me about... He wanted to do a Yellow Submarine ballet. with a guy called Matthew Bourne. And I thought it was a bit camp for me. I didn't really know anything about ballet. And I had an idea that we could do a Beatles thing with this company called Della Guarda, who are a Cirque du Soleil-like. And so there was a bunch of things bubbling under, and I was unhappy with this position in the record label. And so I went off and did the Jubilee concert.
Okay, before you, how long did you work at Sony?
A year and a half.
Oh, so not really that long. Oh, I thought it was years.
No, because I was in a band.
Okay.
And then, you know, and then did the, and got, when I was broke, the guy phoned me up, did the job.
Oh, I thought it was like 6 or 9 years.
No. I wouldn't have been able to, I'm not sensible enough to stand that long.
So they called you for the Queen's Jubilee. How did they call you? How did they find you?
They called me because they wanted me, you know, because I was my, you know, it's nepotism. I was my father's son, and they thought I could do the job. They called me to see if I could record it. They wanted to release a DVD. And I can't remember what I'd done before, but I'd done something like that before. And so, you know, I decided how many trucks we should get in, all this sort of stuff. And I turned up to the first meeting, and Michael Kamen, do you know Jim Michael Kamen?
Well, the irony is my girlfriend runs a foundation that he started, Mr. Holland's Opus Foundation.
Right.
The other thing I will say, he was originally in a band called the New York Rock and Roll Ensemble, and I saw them open for the Allman Brothers in 1973. For those people who don't know, he went on to have a long career,
yeah.
You know, writing the Robin Hood song, writing musical scores, working with Metallica. Yeah. I certainly know Michael
Kamen. An amazing man. So I'd met...
He unfortunately died of MS about 10 years ago.
So Michael I'd met in... Japan, because he was involved in this crazy Japanese concert I mentioned. And he was doing the Queen's Jubilee. And
what was his role?
He was the music director, but he hadn't told anyone how ill he was. And so I turned up the meeting as me being the recording person.
Right.
And they said to me, would you take on the role of doing music director for some of the artists for the Queen's Jubilee? And it was a fantastic. They had these artists lined up, and you know, I was basically rehearsing the band, rehearsing the artists, that kind of stuff, make sure. And it was like, you know, they had Brian Wilson.
Right.
Like, well, I'll do Brian Wilson. I'd love to work with Brian Wilson. Right. And they go, in that case, you have to do Ricky Martin and Miss. And I go, well, I'll do Ray Davies. He's doing Lola. That'd be great. I'd love to do that. And they go, okay, in that case, you have to do Cliff Richard and S Club 7, or you know, that was the way it would work. So I did that, and underneath the same.
Just so I understand, for those people who are amateurs, if it's a band like if a band comes and you're the musical director, and they normally perform, what are you actually telling them to do?
Well, quite often it's not a band coming. You have a you talk to them first, and you say, "How do you want to do the song?" And they go, "Oh, well, you know." I did this gig once in, you know, whatever, and we did it like that. Because generally, they have a house band. The house band that because was actually Phil Collins on drums, Pino again on bass. So I knew the band anyway.
I see. So you're not bringing your own band.
They're not bringing their own band. You know, I mean, like, I think we had, you know, the Black Sabbath was Tony Iommi and Ozzy.
Right.
So, but the band were with Phil Collins on drums.
Still don't use the drummer.
Yeah. So they still use. So it was making sure that everyone knew their parts. And then
just to go back, because it's another interesting thing. This is live.
This is live. Yeah.
Okay. Question. Because I had some road dogs. I've gotten into this. Your act is playing the Super Bowl. Would you ever do it live or too many risks?
Yeah, it's funny. I think that I would love to do it live. I just think it's funny. We did this thing. We made a huge mistake at the Olympic Games. the opening Olympic Games. Okay, it always haunts me. Where Paul McCartney performed, and they wanted him to mime, and he can't mime because he doesn't use in-ear monitors. He refuses to use in-ear monitors.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, he uses, you know.
Oh, he uses regular monitors. Doesn't use in-ear monitors.
Yeah, he uses wedges.
Right.
And I said, well, maybe we could still mime. And I worked out this way in which he could do it. And he forgot he was miming. And so they were doing playback. I recorded the band playing live.
Right.
And then he started too early. And there were two Paul McCartneys playing at the same time. And I pressed the button to go to live in front of a billion people. You know, I had to press this red button. And I said to him, God, you know, I said, it didn't go very well, Paul. I goes, yeah, but to be honest, if you're going to mess up, do it in front of a billion people.
I have a sense of humor.
Yeah, yeah. So that's, yeah, I don't know. I think that I love, you know, I'm a natural risk taker. It's like one of those, like, yeah, well, let's just go for it. You know, what's going to happen? I mean, there are worse things happen in the world every day. You know, I don't believe in, you know, there's this...
Now, you did Paul McCartney in the opening of the Olympics. Did you do the closing, too?
No.
Okay, so you do the Queen's Jubilee, and that works out great.
Yeah, I do the Queen's Jubilee, and then I was, like, sat and thinking, what do I do now?
Right, you work with the Queen, right.
Now, what do I do now? And the phone's not ringing. My manager phoned me up and said, I've got you a gig. And I was like, great, am I working with Supergrass? I loved Supergrass. And they were like, no, you're working with...
The irony, did Supergrass not make it because the guys were so unattractive?
I don't know. They made some nice records.
No, they made phenomenal records.
The Money's a great album.
Exactly. And I bought those albums. Zero impact in the U.S.
Yeah, none. I don't know. But he goes, you're working with a 15-year-old classical singer. I was like, right. And he said, you haven't got anything else. You've got nothing. This is it. And so I did this record with this girl called Hayley Weston Ra, who's a New Zealand singer. And it was an album that I did by, it was like painting my numbers. I was like, okay, this track will get onto Radio 2 in the UK. This track will get onto daytime television. This track will. And she ended up selling, it ended up being the fastest selling classical record of all time in the UK and sold 2 million copies.
Wow. And did you ride along with that? Did that burnish your image?
Yeah, it completely. I brought it to a friend of mine when I was trying to be cool. And I said, I guess I'll never work with any of your bands again. He goes, no. He goes, it's amazing. Even Chris Martin, I said to Chris Martin, Coldplay singer, we had lunch and he goes, it's amazing the success you've had. I was like, yeah, but I'll never work there. He goes, no, you won't. I suddenly became the king of crossover classical, which is, I'm not sure how much you're allowed to use rude words on your
podcast. No, we can, no problem.
But the email correspondent was always goat shagging. For some reason, it was tantamount to goat shagging. I don't know why we always said that it was, and that's that. Then I got busted for being rude about crossover classical by someone. Because I just it wasn't a world that I liked. It was that easy path.
So you had the best of times and the worst of times. You had success, but not in the field.
I had success, and I had and I could have then gone and done everything crossover classical with they were queuing up. Because I'd opened that door to, and it was then that with this undercurrent I mentioned before, my father wanted to Yellow Submarine, and we had an idea that the Cirque du Soleil and the Beatles signed their deal to do the Love Show, and Cirque du Soleil had got a DJ in to remix the Beatles songs, and it was a disaster. And none of us knew about this, and I met Neil Aspinall, who was the head of Apple. And my father at that time was actually quite seriously ill. He was in the hospital. And I just had this success. People just saw it as success. They hadn't listened to the record I'd done. And and even Paul came up to me and goes, well done with that record. I was like, obviously you hadn't listened to it with a bad version of Ave Maria on it. And I said to Neil, and I was into that chopping up stuff at that stage, and I said to Neil Aspinall, it's one of those, I reckon I can create a Beatles concert that never happened by chopping up their tapes. He went, really? I said, yeah, I've got an idea. I could do this drum introduction, and I can imagine, how the band would perform. And let's face it, they played live on all their tapes, so I could just chop up their tapes and create a sound bed for a show. And he said, okay, you've got 3 months, and I'm not paying you. From then, I went into a room at Abbey Road. To begin with, I didn't even have any speakers. They just gave me headphones. And I did like 4 or 5 different things for the show.
And did it take 3 months?
No, it took 3 months for me to transfer a lot of the tapes.
Right, I was just going to ask that. I'm glad you said that.
Yeah, my dad came out of hospital. He was being treated for cancer, and... he didn't really like it very much. It was funny. He did. At the time, he was like, I think you pushed this a little bit too far here. I don't think I like it. And Paul came in, and Ringo came in, and Livinger and Yoko, and I played them some stuff. And I did this version of Within You, Without You, and Tomorrow Never Knows I'd mixed together. And my dad banned me from playing it to them. And then Paul goes, you should push it further. And I went, oh, I've got this thing,
Right.
I don't know, I'm pretending, but for the listeners, I'm pretending to hold up a disc. Of course, he didn't have it on the disc.
Right.
And I played to him because this is brilliant. This is what we should do. And it sort of that then unlocked that door. And I remember being in New York I was writing music for a singer, and I've got a phone call saying, "Yeah, we're under contract. You're doing this show. You're doing this Beatles show." And I remember phoning up a friend of mine saying, who's a producer, and said, "I'm not sure if I should do this because if I do this, this is what I'll be doing. It fits everyone's."
Right.
And I said, I'm not sure if I want to be the the legacy guy. And he said to me, you do know that if you don't do this, I'll do it. You know, and I thought to myself, you know, you've got a good point. And I actually remind myself when I'm working on this stuff, it's like, you know, yeah, I'm pretty lucky to be trusted with this material. So yeah, I did the Love Show in Vegas, and that opened the door.
Okay, it was billed as a collaboration between yourself and your father.
Yeah, and it was it's bizarre. He was producing me. I guess he produced me as a child, but he was producing me in respect to, he would come in mainly on a Thursday. We'd always go to the same restaurant for lunch. He'd come on a Thursday because he lived out of London, and I would play him what I'd done, and he'd go, "No, this is and even though his hearing wasn't that great, he would be able to judge it and give me advice, but I created the stuff and mixed it.
Well, as I say, I didn't know till this day that it all started with you, yeah, and Neil.
Yeah, and then what happened was I got quite defensive because my dad was a big influence. Obviously, he's a big influence on me, full stop. But he was a big, and Ringo came once and said, "You know, well." You know, I said, "Dad's just getting coffee." He goes, "Well, I know that he hasn't. He's not. You know." I said, "No, but that's not, he is my." You know, my guidance on this. And then when I went out to Vegas and I did a lot of the work out in the show itself, in the theater, we built the theater, designed the speaker system. I remember I redid Here Comes the Sun. I redid the introduction to Here Comes the Sun. And I suddenly realized my dad wasn't there. And it felt really dirty that Cirque du Soleil would hear this before he heard it. And then you realize, you know, it's then, you know, it's easy to take for. And then, funny enough, you know, when he felt slightly excluded because I was just going off there and with a mouse, you know, right, and a computer and doing this stuff. And it was, I remember saying to him, because it's amazing, Giles, you know, it's like, you know, audio to you is like putty, isn't it? The way you can manipulate in all sorts of ways, the way he would speak.
Was he hip on all the new technologies?
No, but he loved it. Okay. He was hip as far as, mind you, the fact of the matter is that I get assistants now that think I'm good on Pro Tools because I did Love, but I really have no idea at all. I mean, my sessions look like a Jackson Pollock painting. You know, nothing tidy about the way I worked. And it's funny. I mean, I think if I'd known my stuff, I would have done a worse job. I mean, I started off with there's a drum solo from The End, which is a song on Abbey Road, and I decided to mix Get Back as an introduction to it and put the piano chord back, you know, do a bunch of stuff. And the way you do that, if you're a modern artist, is you put a grid and you put the drums in time and you put everything and you lock everything together. And I started doing that, and I put Ringo perfectly in time, and it completely killed the feel of the band. And then I realized, okay, it has to be the band dictating the heartbeat of this show and not me chopping the music up, if that makes any sense.
Yes, totally.
So I learned, you know, you have to know when you do things badly is the key to good work. So and then when it came to, Olivia Harrison came to see me and said, you know, "I don't want to use the demo to While My Guitar Gently Weeps." The director of the show wants to use the demo to While My Guitar Gently Weeps. Which is just a Georgian acoustic guitar. It was on an anthology. And I said, well, you know, I had an idea. I said, you know, well, I could get my dad to finish it. He could do a string arrangement. And Danny Harrison was there. And he goes, "Do you think he could?" I said, "Yeah." And I'll phone him up. I phoned him up there. I said,
"Right."
And he said to me, and it's funny, you know, go back to that conversation we had when he was dying. He said, I said, "Dad," he goes, "I'm not sure I can do it anymore." I said, he goes, I haven't done a string arrangement for 10 years. I said, "I'm sure you can, Dad." And I'd actually done there's the introduction, which is on the record on the show, I did. And I said, you know, and we sat at the piano. It was really nice. I sat at the piano. I said, and he goes, "Oh, that's nice. There's a G minor progression." He goes, "Well, you know, this is." And he went off, and then we went to the studios and recorded a full, it's on film actually, a string section playing. And everyone knew in the orchestra that this would be the last time that he would work. I knew it'd be the last time he'd work. He was 80 years old or 79 years old, couldn't hear anything, and we steered through, and it's a beautiful arrangement. If you ever hear it, it's a really sympathetic arrangement. And actually, at his memorial service, I had the guy, a singer-songwriter who's very good, called James Bay, who's a friend of mine. He sang it, "I Want Someone Agnostic," and we had a string section play it. And it's just like my dad was really good. He was really good. You know, it's that I couldn't do that. He's really good.
Okay, now you're doing the Beatles Love Show. You know it's going to be a success. You're not sure.
I had no idea. I thought, I didn't want to do crossover classical music. And this was like a fun thing to do. And it was also a really good way of getting to know my dad and going through his closet and learning stuff. You know, I went through every single take of every single Beatles track. And made notes, you know, because I thought I'd better... And in fact, I thought I'd get fired. I really thought it's such a bad idea. The son of George Martin chops up the Beatles tapes for a show in Las Vegas is disgusting. It probably read about in your blog. It would be a shocker. You know, it's like I disagree with the principle entirely, apart from the fact that for me it was better than doing the other thing I was doing. And it came out and everyone liked it. I honestly thought if I could do one thing, I'll back up all the tapes because they hadn't been backed up. And then if I can finish...
You were literally using the master tapes?
Yeah, you have to use the master tapes. They sound great. And so I backed
up... But isn't there a limit, you know, what kind of condition...
Well, you only have to play them once to back them up.
That's my point. But yeah. I'm surprised that no one had done that previously.
They hadn't done it previously. And so I thought, you know what? If I get fired and leave one thing behind, at least I've backed up the tapes properly. You know, that was my motivation. I thought, you know, at least I've done something right. And it came out, and it, you know, it's still going now. I think it's been seen by 7.5 million people.
Now, that was recently redone.
Yeah, I went back and redid it.
And what did you change?
The show was looking old. It was mainly a visual thing. The show was looking old and looking a bit tired. And myself and Dominic, who's the guy I did the show with, who's a lovely man. Actually, his name is Dominic Champagne, which is a great name. We took together and we said, it's looking old, and we persuaded everyone to invest. I remixed the entire show from start to front. Because, you know, if you think about it, when we did the show, we did it on computers. We had to do it on computers. I couldn't bring Abbey Road to. And we're using plugins and all sorts of things. And they've got a lot better.
Right.
And I retransferred all the tapes as well. And so we did. And then I bought new speakers and you know, we listened differently. That's the funny thing about music is we listen differently. How music is when you remember it and how music is when you listen to it again, it can be different, can be worse.
Go a little deeper there.
Well, it demands of, you know, when we did the show, it was the best-sounding show, I think one of the best-sounding shows in the world, probably. I mean, it should be. We had 7,000 speakers in a room, even though we're in the round. And by the time 3 years ago, you know, Celine Dion sounded better because there's more weight in the bass. There's more, you know, there's more visceral presence in the sound that's hitting you and all this sort of stuff. And the Beatles show sounded light. You know, we expect this sort of thing to hit us in the chest now, which didn't happen 13 years ago. And so, I was working in the theater, and I said to the guys, I said, I need 200, around about 200, 250 hertz is what thumps you in the chest. It's bizarre, it's not lower. It's around about that. And they were like, you know, when you're breaking the system. You're breaking the system. I said, well, how do I not break the system? He goes, you need more speakers. So I got up, I walked across the casino, knocked on the casino owner's door, can you buy me some more speakers, please? And he said, yeah, I think they're $180,000. He goes, are they going to make a difference to you? I said, yeah. And he goes, okay, like spoiled child. And that's the way it works. And I mean, the casino were incredibly, it's funny, my previous, if you'd asked me, and it's vague, I'm not, as you can tell probably, I'm not Mr. Vegas, but they're very supportive, and I like them. I still like the people there a lot. And they were like, listen, if you think it's going to make a difference, then okay, we'll do it. So I redid things.
How did you end up remixing Sgt. Pepper?
It wasn't something that I necessarily felt compelled to do. A lot of this stuff comes from the desire comes from, it's the 50th anniversary. Well, it's the 50th anniversary. What are we going to do? You know, there's outtakes, there's this. And I'd played around with, privately played around with remixing Beatles tracks. You know, I did it for Love, and the Love album was very well received as far as an audio perspective goes. I get given a lot of credit for things that I didn't do. You know, you put the tapes into a machine and you put the faders up and it sounds pretty good.
Right.
And generally what happens is the processes that make a record in those days, the continual. I mean, like if you remaster a quarter-inch tape or a half-inch tape that's a mix, it gets worn down. So the tapes get worn out. And with Sgt. Pepper, Apple Corps, who were the Beatles company. They wanted to do something about the 50th anniversary re-release, and we talked about it, and they wanted to go through all the outtakes and stuff like that. And funnily enough, my father passed away, and I took some time off, obviously, took 2 weeks off, and then I went back to the studios, and the first voice I heard was his, which is kind of odd. And it's, Yoko said to me when we were doing the Love Show, I was sitting here with the Love Show, and I used voices in the Love Show of the Beatles, and she said, it's funny, you know, John's just a voice now. And I know how she felt. And we started remixing Sergeant Pepper. You know, people want to do a surround, so you end up doing a stereo. And we got it wrong. It didn't sound right. And then after about four songs, I suddenly realized, actually, this kind of sounds good. Not better, it just sounds good. And the monos had been... You know, I never heard the mono version of Sergeant Pepper. I'm not that sort of person. It's a terrible thing to say, I should be. But I never heard the monos, and the mono mixes are different. I think they're more claustrophobic. They're more psychedelic in some ways. There's more effects on them because the Beatles couldn't put effects on the stereo. The technology wasn't there. It's ADT voices with stereo. The voice, you know, there's a bunch of things that just the vary speed techniques they used weren't there. And so we started doing it. And again, you know, you do these things behind closed doors. And I actually said to Apple...
Well, how did you switch from surround to doing a stereo? Remix?
You do a stereo first. You have to do a stereo. My pathway to surround is stereo.
Okay.
Because you have to get the stereo right before you do the surround. Otherwise, the weight's not there in the surround. It becomes... I don't know if you hear some surround mixes, and I don't want to criticize anyone else's work, but some surround mixes sound too... ambient. They sound, you know, the if you think about the cool thing about surround is you have a center speaker, you have that mono thing that can hit you, and it's like I see it like smashing toffee with a toffee hammer, where you have that center and everything can explode around it, like when you listen to a great mono record and that happens in your head anyway. That's the way I see it. And so with Sergeant Pepper, I said, listen, if this isn't right, then and you have to, and it's a brave thing to do. And then it came out, and people liked it, you know. It's funny. It's someone wrote to me the other day and said, we can't get hold of a copy of the vinyl mix of Sgt. Pepper did last year because it's sold out. And I went to Universal. I went, you know, you can buy the original one, which I should say, you do buy that one. But, you know, I don't think about the marketing aspects of it when I do it. I just think about, you know, what bothers me. I suppose my motivation is that when you play a record that's important to you, to a younger generation, and they think it sounds old. They think it sounds old because it may not be as loud, it may not be as stereo, it may not be as immersive as the tracks they're listening to. And we live in a world of a global jukebox where there's no reverence to... I mean, it's coming back, but there's no reverence to putting on a record. You can have, you know, Kendrick Lamar next to Lucian Sky with Diamonds. It doesn't make any difference. And the thing about music and the thing about recording is that it doesn't. A recording is, by that, it is a capturing a 25-year-old person at their prime. And I want them to be 25 forever. And I want them to be bursting out of your speakers. Not in an angry, compressed, you know, to the max way, but I just want to make sure that you feel like you're in the room with them. And so that was kind of the motivation.
Okay, we'll return to this conversation with Giles Martin, sound experience leader for Sonos and son of George Martin and producer and mixer extraordinaire in his own right, in a moment. You're listening to the Bob Lefsetz podcast, recorded at the TuneIn Studios in Venice, California. Each week, I interview a new guest to get their story. While they're here, we take photos and shoot some videos so you can see what they really look like. Want to see what Giles looks like? Check us out on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Follow at TuneIn. Let's dive right back in with my guest, Giles Martin, producer extraordinaire. Well, it's kind of interesting. I have no problem with what you... Well, at first, when I first heard about it, it's a little bit of a hump. What you did with Love. That's a totally new work. Remixing something that I know so well. It's all akin to owning a vinyl record and then getting the CD when you were listening for the skips and the pops that weren't there anymore. You know the originals so well.
Yeah.
So that, do you have plans to remix any more Beatles records?
Not at the moment. I mean, there's talking about it, but It's not, you know, and I think to answer that, I completely understand what you're saying. I kind of, you know, part of me agrees with it. At the same time, I'm not doing it for you, Bob.
Exactly. That's what I was thinking. You know, your explanation is very good.
I think if we get to the stage where people are loving the pops and the clicks, if we people listen that much, we live in a world where, you know, we hear things that we don't listen. You know, it's ubiquitous wall of sound constantly going on. There's noise constantly going on. And that time which you talk about where you have that record and you love that record, you put it on. You know, if there's a reason, if, you know, there's two ways. You know, even if people don't like what I do, they're listening to it. Mm-hmm. And I don't have a problem with that. It's like, great, don't like it. That's super. That's why I don't mind you. And when I wrote back to you, I said, I don't mind you saying this stuff. It's like, you know, the fact you have passion and opinion is what I like. That's the whole point. It's like, you know, great. You know, we live in a world where it's just a record. And there's various moments in our lives where they're not just records. They're things that mean a great deal to us. Now, I'm not trying to take that away from you in any way whatsoever. Absolutely not. But if I can stir things up so people, like, slap people around the face and go, see, I was wrong or I was right or whatever, at least it's getting attention.
At least you have an opinion. Now, you also work with Sonos at this point. How did you end up coming to work with Sonos?
Well, that was a strange thing that happened about 4 years ago. I was actually working. I did Paul McCartney's album, New. This was back, and I was working over here in L.A. in Henson, and a guy came to see me, and I was with a great mix engineer called Spike Stent, who mixed.
I know Spike.
Good friend of mine, lovely Spike. And he came to see us, and it was Sonos had a speaker called the Play One, Thomas Meyer, who came to see me, he said, you know, can we give you some speakers? And there's about the fourth speaker company that come up to me, because since the Love record, there was, you know, Love's used for surround hi-fi.
Right.
It's a, you know, the Socks and Sandals Brigade, I suit. And I got home, my wife goes, you know, what are these boxes doing in our there's speakers, and what do we want speakers for? And I was like, oh, you might like these ones because they're small, you know. And I plugged them in, my attitude was like, I think, thank you very much. And I thought, actually, they sound pretty good. And then they sent me
just for the record, the Sonos One is a small speaker.
This was pre-Sonos One. This was a 5 and a 3.
Okay.
They sent me, and they sent me a play bar. And I was like, wow, this is great. I've got free gear. And, you know, I'm a bloke, so I like, you know, not to be sexist, but we tend to be slightly more obsessive over gear. You know, we're sad individuals.
Right. I'm one of them, okay?
Yeah, I know. And then what happened was is they brought they showed me a One, and I had comments on it. I thought it was limiting too much, and there was various things I didn't like that it was doing. And then
this was before or after it was manufactured?
Before it was manufactured.
Okay.
And they realized I was engaged, and they asked me, they said they have Rick Rubin on their soundboard, and they have Hans Zimmer. I said, would I join their soundboard? And I said, yeah. And then I thought, well, and it was one of the things they sort of got me more involved in the company. I think they gave me some shares, and it was this thing. I was like, you know, and I liked them. You know, they were the first speaker company. People had come up to me before and said, you know, what do you think of our speakers? They come to see me in the studios, and I said, and I'd say what I thought. And they would go, you're wrong. And I go, okay. But that's great. I don't mind being wrong. Absolutely. But don't get upset for me.
But just so I know, it used to be the standard in UK studios were Tannoys.
Okay. Yeah, it's all sorts now.
Okay. So when you mix, what do you mix to?
I mix using ATCs. They're a company. I live in the country. They're about 20 miles away. I didn't know this until recently. But a lot of people now use ATCs. Nigel Godrich, who actually also works for Sonos, he uses ATCs, I think. It's a different world. I mean, I asked for it to buy a new pair of ATCs, and the guy said, can you wait a month? We have to build them. You know, so it's a different world to the world. And so when I'm with Sonos, they're the first company that asked me what I didn't like.
Right.
And when I started giving them compliments, they switched off. Like, we're not interested. And then the head of the company came to see me and said, you know,
this is Sonos.
This is Sonos, and said, you know, would you be our sound experience leader? And I mean, I said, no. I said, for a start, it sounds too American for me. I said, what does it mean? He goes, leading our sound experience. I was like, well, obviously, but what does that mean?
Right, right.
And it's kind of like, my job is almost like head of sound, I suppose, the company, where the appealing thing, I like pushing technology, pushing the way we listen. That's what appealed to me about the Love Show. It's like making people, locking people in a room in Vegas and making them listen to great music there's something in my subversive mind that appeals to me about that. And the fact, if you think about it, we can't get away from the fact we make files now. We don't make records. We do make files. That's what happens. I know that, you know, vinyl is cut from files a lot of the time.
Exactly. That's why I don't understand it.
Yeah. So
now, just to stop there for a second. Yeah. If we're starting with the file, how can the vinyl record sound better than the file?
That's a really, and it's a very good question. And does it sound better or does it not sound? But there's something about vinyl that takes away the top and the bottom. And it does also, I'm a really, deep technical person when it comes to mixing. And people, maybe mistakenly like what I do. But when I did Sgt. Pepper, I remastered. And I mastered with a guy in Abbey Road, and then I mastered myself. And then we cut the vinyl. He did a half-speed vinyl cut, which is, a deeper, right, more precise cut. I listened to the vinyl. It's like, wow, this sounds great. And it makes me feel, in my sort of strange control freak way, it makes me slightly annoyed because I didn't do this. The vinyl was just a happenstance that went on vinyl. I liked the sound of it. Does that make sense?
I'm not totally sure. So we have the file, and we're losing something on the vinyl.
You're losing
on
the vinyl.
So inherently, vinyl has a sound. Are you saying that you like the vinyl sound?
I like the vinyl sound of the Sgt. Pepper mix I did. It sounds nice spatially. It sounds smooth. It sounds good. But I didn't. I'm not responsible for that. Vinyl did that, not me. And that's what I. It's a thing. And the thing that appeals. Going back to the process with Sonos is the fact that if the dream really is to for whether it's myself or Spike or whoever in a studio, you can make a decision on this is how it should sound, and you send it down a wire and it appears in your home exactly the same.
Right.
That's what appealed to me with something like Sonos, where you can go, okay, I can tweak the speaker. And I started doing this with people's speakers they have in the marketplace, where I was like, so I can change that sound of that play bar and make it. And I did it three times, the play bar, without people knowing, change the sound of it after people bought it.
I know. You did updates.
Yeah.
And I'm aware of this. What did you actually change?
Well, it's funny. Rick Rubin was unhappy with the play bar, and this is before I was heavily involved. And he phoned me about it, and I said, yeah, it sounds a bit weird for stereo music. It doesn't sounds like it's doing something nasty, and it was doing pretty well. It was selling. It was getting good reviews. I've always been interested in bad reviews anyway, so it was getting good reviews, and we worked out a way of. It's always tough when you have a speaker. Like, a lot of products now are more than two channel speakers. They have to create wide width and
right.
All sort of stuff. You have two
fake 5.1.
Yeah, or it's actually fake stereo because if you imagine the way you and I would traditionally listen to music is with two speakers, the two mono speakers. Without getting too techie here, but you have a phantom center,
right?
So there's no center speaker, but you sit in the middle, and what's equal left and right is in mono, and then the rest left and right. Modern day speakers that pretty much everyone makes now that are stereo, they have phantom left and right. They're trying to fire things out left and right, which means you can often have a hole in the center, like a lifesaver.
Let me ask you a question. If we're talking specifically about Sonos product, the 3, the 5, the 1, what happens then when I pair them and I get stereo?
They work in a traditional way.
Okay, so the software is such that if I'm using 1 or I'm using 2, it makes an adjustment.
Yeah. They know where they are and they know what they're doing, and that's the beauty of it. So yeah, with the play, we changed the play bar because Rick said it doesn't sound like a stereo, and I was like, well, it's not a stereo, so how do we make it sound like a stereo? So I had a very clever team and we worked on that. But it's fun. It's like, it's a bit like, it's in a funny way, it's a bit like The Love Show, where in that theater there is in Vegas, I'm in control of the input and the output. So I'm in control. If you go and sit there and you don't like it, then it's purely my fault.
Right.
Opposed to if you make a mix and then you, you listen to. I'm not one of those people that has an opinion of whether you listen to. I mean, I fell in love with music listened to on AM radio. So I think you could be with a loved one on a sunny day and a record comes on, it could sound like the best it's ever sounded, even though it doesn't sound like that, if that makes sense. You fill in the gaps. At the same time, if you can facilitate, if there can be somewhere where a bunch of us creators have an influence on the output side as well, then it can only be a good thing, because very, very clever audio people have no idea what a mix should sound like.
And then these speakers adjust for the listening environment.
Yeah, it's fine. I mean, I've known friends that that are hi-fi buffs, and they'll spend, you know, $30,000 to $100,000 on a speaker, and then put them next to a wall, and you think, well, you know, you might as well spend $500 on a speaker then, because you're going to get the amount of bass resonance you get from next to a wall. There's a, where you place something is really important in audio because of a room, and so. When I first started working on Sonos, I came across a guy called Tim Sheen, who was like a sort of a clever bearded elf wandering around with a microphone with a speaker in the corner of the room, and he was just on his own in this room. And I said, "What's he doing?" And they said, "Well, he thinks he can speak and tune itself, you know, or he can tune to a room." I said, "That's great," and no one else was that happy, because the ethos of a product not having a constant and changing was something that speakers don't really do at that stage. And Tim Sheen was, then the company got behind him, and we got behind him, and it would end up being a really cool thing where you don't have to worry about where you put a speaker.
So what's the future of home audio?
Well, I think that you and I need to talk about the future of home audio and the future of music distribution is a bigger question. The future of home audio, I think that if we can make music as real as possible, I like that vinyl's coming back. I like the fact that people have to make an effort to listen. I also love the fact that with something like Sonos, you can have I sit with my kids in the kitchen, and I have a bunch of pieces of paper which have reggae, funk, jazz, soul on them. And they get points if I put on a piece of music, and they can guess which genre it is. they love doing it. I don't know why. It's just one of those things. And I love the fact that you can think of a song and play it. But I think home audio is better than it's ever has been in that respect, where it's, you can listen out loud and listen collectively, and it doesn't matter. But the future, The way that voice is going and that speakers are becoming a portal is interesting. I think that speed of thought behind thinking of a song and playing it is very clever, is very good.
Well, I find a lot of times in my work area, I have an amazing amount of stereo gear, and I will call out to the voice-activated speaker where Alexa are now the new Sonos. I'd rather do that, even though it's coming out of one little speaker.
Yeah, and it's getting that. The thing is, it's getting that better and better. That's the thing. I think the question is how do we improve search and discovery? At one stage, I spent a lot of my own money thinking of this portal where you could travel through time, you could find influences in music. So if you like this, then what went on before and what went on before, and you could search music through influences and stuff like that, and there's got to be ways in which we can, in the same way I miss the record sleeve. I miss the fact that that I knew that Jim Gordon played on right. Layla, and all that kind of stuff. That connection would be. I think there's it's that thing when you go into a record store. And I remember actually I was going to work on a show with Quincy at one stage, and I thought, I've got to learn about the heritage of black music. Where'd you start? And I went to a record store called Honest John's on Portobello Road, and I walked in there and started talking to this guy, and I was there for 6.5 hours. And he played everything, Ella Fitzgerald records, Wilson Pickett kind of rarities. And it was like, this is, how do we get this?
I certainly believe that music discovery is broken. Yeah. I believe as a result, it's like the internet at large. There's so many messages coming that the average person is overwhelmed. But in the time you have left, which is pretty lengthy in terms of your life, hopefully, what would you like to achieve or see happen?
I think that it's difficult to, it's really easy to say it wasn't like it was in my day. But I would like generations to be as touched by music as I was, and not reliant on visual as people seem to be now. I don't think that'll ever go, because visual always wins. I mean, I've worked on films, I've worked on shows.
Well, that's an interesting thing. I was talking to somebody, they're talking about how powerful Instagram is, which makes no sense to me because all you have is the picture.
Yeah.
But, and we may not be at the end of the stream here, now on streaming services, the number of plays there exceeds YouTube. So maybe we have hope.
Yeah, and I think that it's so I think what would I like to achieve? There are so many things I'd like to achieve. I like to, you know, there's sort of shows and experiences and visceral things I'm working on that involve music. So you know even you had one idea that I did, like walking through a groove of a record. You know, so imagine Ben being shrunk. You know, for kids to realize what the
I can picture it. I've seen enough. You know, blow up pictures.
Yeah, you know,
it's like a giant mountain range.
You know, there's fun stuff. You know, I mean, we work on a couple of things with some creators where I like the idea. And he says going against the visual world, but I like the idea of there being, you know, the fun thing about the Love Show is like you're creating a. You know, it's by no means perfect, but you're getting kids to discover music and listen to and connect music and listen to music in different ways, and they go out feeling different. If you can make people feel something different, then that's great. So what appeals to me is, you know, even with Sgt. Pepper, I did this Atmos mix of Sgt. Pepper, which is basically a room with 55 speakers in it, and a bunch of artists and creators have been in there, and they come out in floods of tears. You know, they come up with floods of tears. They feel like what you can do with immersive audio is you can put the band in the room with you. You can get reflections from Studio 2, which is what we do, and you can make people feel like you're in this space with the band. You know, and it's getting that. If you can, if in any work I do, if I can just stimulate that feeling in some way, if I can get people to, there's nothing better. I remember even working on that concert in Japan all those years ago. Joni Mitchell sat in front of me, and she played Hajira on the guitar. And she was sitting as far away from you are, you know, we are about 5 feet away from each other. And I wasn't even a big Joni Mitchell fan. I didn't even know much about her. You know, I was a blues guy, and I couldn't work out where the music was coming from. It was coming from. I saw her mouth moving, and I could see her playing the guitar. But it was like this sort of ethereal noise that was hitting me, and it's better than anything else in life having that experience. And so I suppose that through the huge privilege I've had from being my father's son, I've experienced some things. I mean, like, you know, I remember being a tape op, which is an assistant engineer, and working on a Mark Knopfler session. He played acoustic guitar, and I was like, is that him playing, or is I'm listening to a record? You know, it's that weird thing. And you, or being in the same room as Stevie Wonder when he's playing the piano, and if I can get people, whether it's through Sonos, whether it's through mixing, whether it's doing shows or doing exhibits, if I can get that feeling of inspiration closer to the listener, then that would be an achievement. That's what we try and do.
Well, we've just gone to the mountaintop there. I don't think I can add anything. Giles, you've been a fabulous guest, both telling the stories of yourself, the Beatles, and your father. Thanks so much for being here.
Oh, pleasure, Bob. Thank you so much.
That wraps up this week's episode of the Bob Lefsetz Podcast, recorded here at the TuneIn Studios in Venice, California. I hope you liked listening to this conversation with Giles Martin, producer extraordinaire. Please let me know what you think of the show. Email me at bob@lefsetz.com. Until next time, I'm Bob Lefsetz.